This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With Capella University's FlexPath format, you can set your own deadlines, learn at your pace, and access most coursework from anywhere at any time. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Due to the graphic nature of this investigation and trial, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of abuse, murder, and sexuality that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. It was nearly midnight when 29-year-old Lynn Dejack threw open her front door and stumbled inside. Her boyfriend, Dennis Donahue, was hot on her heels, hurling accusations of infidelity. Lynn screamed right back, demanding that he leave. Lynn's 13-year-old daughter, Crystalyn Gerard, rushed into the living room when she heard the commotion. Even though Lynn and Dennis had only been together for 2 months, Crystal was used to the fighting. She was always ready to protect her mother. As Lynn continued commanding Dennis to get out of the house, Crystal helped her get the phone to call the police. But as soon as she picked up the receiver, Dennis knocked it out of Lynn's hand and onto the floor. Lynn scrambled after the phone and dialed. As soon as the 911 operator picked up, Dennis finally walked out the door. He didn't need the hassle of the police showing up. Satisfied, Lynn simply hung up. Then she headed out herself, telling Crystal she was going to the bar down the street. When police arrived at the house a few minutes later to respond to Lynn's 911 call, they knocked on the door repeatedly, but no one answered, so they left. Less than 14 hours later, they responded to another call at the Dejack home. This time, they found 13-year-old Crystal dead in her bed. How should we determine a person's guilt? Do we defer to the evidence discovered by police or the verdict reached by a jury? And what happens when the evidence and the verdict don't line up? Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson, and this is Not Guilty, a Parcast original. Each week, we look at complicated criminal cases that test the limits of innocent until proven guilty. You can find episodes of Not Guilty and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Not Guilty for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Not Guilty in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. This week, we're examining the 1993 death of 13-year-old Crystalyn Gerard. We'll examine her chaotic family life, the investigation into her death, and how police narrowed down their suspects. Next week, we'll follow the resulting criminal trial and the aftermath. We'll see for ourselves how the evidence matches up with the verdict. Lynn's neighbors were used to hearing yelling coming from the Dejack home. The 29-year-old regularly fought with whatever man she was currently dating. But the screams they heard around 2:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, February 14, 1993, weren't from an argument. They were primal, a mother in agony. The neighbors rushed to the house and found Lynn inconsolably sobbing. Her friend, Keith Kramer, was already on the phone with 911. He told the dispatcher to send help quickly. Lynn's 13-year-old daughter, Crystalyn Gerard, appeared to be dead. When paramedics arrived, Lynn was hysterical. She could hardly catch her breath as she told them her daughter was dead. Paramedics found Crystal in her room, lying across her bed, nude except for a pair of socks. She was cool to the touch. The paramedic checked for a pulse, knowing he wouldn't find one. Then they backed out of the bedroom. It was time for homicide detectives Michael Lyons and Henry Smards to take over. They noticed the front door was intact, no signs of a break-in. The living room was also largely undisturbed, except for a pair of Crystal's underwear on the floor. However, entering the bedroom was a different story. The bedside table was overturned, and there was blood spatter on the wall from a wound on Crystal's head. The scene was carefully photographed, particularly the overturned table and blood spatter. When they took pictures of Crystal's body, they noticed a cut to her left breast and froth coming from her nose and mouth. Based on the evidence, it looked like Crystal was attacked while she was already in her room, possibly asleep. Whoever murdered her was most likely already familiar with the layout of the apartment, allowing them to come in quietly, meaning Lynn or Crystal probably knew the killer personally. Following this logic, Detectives Lyons and Smards immediately brought Lynn Dejack and her friend Keith Kramer to the police station to make their statements. Keith didn't know much about what had happened over the past 24 hours. He hadn't arrived at the house until around 2 in the afternoon, after Lynn had called him, hysterically crying. She told Keith that she thought Crystal was dead, and he immediately drove over to the apartment. When he checked on Crystal in her room, she was cold and stiff. That's when he called 911. The detectives pressed Lynn for answers. It appeared that Crystal was killed sometime the night before, and yet Lynn didn't find her until the afternoon. Surely she noticed that her daughter didn't come out of her room all day. Lynn tearfully admitted that she had left Crystal at home overnight to care for her 8-year-old half-brother, Edward. Lynn didn't come home until the afternoon, only minutes before Keith called 911. The detectives sat for a moment before proceeding with the questioning. They were shocked that Lynn left her 2 children home alone for so long. So they asked, where was Crystal's father? Why couldn't he have watched the children? Lynn explained that Crystal's father hadn't been in the picture since he knocked her up at 15. Crystal was born in 1979, and Lynn's mother helped her out as she struggled to balance early motherhood with her schooling. Then, after a few years as a single mother, Lynn met Raymond Gerard. He was more than 20 years older than her, but despite the age difference, Lynn was over the moon to find someone she could rely on and who cared for her and Crystal deeply. The two married in the early 1980s, and Raymond legally adopted Crystal. By 1985, Lynn and Raymond had a son of their own, Edward. But ultimately, the relationship was rocky. Raymond accused Lynn of leaving him with the children for weeks and months at a time. She even moved to Reno, Nevada at one point in the late 1980s, leaving him as the sole caretaker of their young children. It was during this time that 10-year-old Crystal dropped a bombshell. She told a neighbor that her adoptive father had been sexually abusing her for years. The neighbor immediately called the police, and Raymond was arrested. When Lynn received the news, she was first shocked, then furious. But soon her own guilt began to build. She never expected Raymond would hurt Crystal, but she couldn't help but wonder if this could have been avoided if she never went to Reno, if she never left her daughter. When Raymond stood trial in 1991, he claimed that Lynn coerced Crystal into making these accusations. But Crystal, by then 11 years old, took the stand and testified against her stepfather. Her account was convincing, and ultimately, Raymond was found guilty. On the night Crystal was murdered, Raymond was where he always was, in state prison, serving a 5 to 15 year sentence for sodomy and child endangerment. In spite of the instability and trauma, Crystal was now a responsible teenager that her mother could depend on. Without a father in the picture, Lynn regularly left Crystal in charge when she went out, and February 13, 1993 was no exception. Lynn explained that on that day, she attended a wedding with her boyfriend, Dennis Donahue. Even though they hadn't been dating long, Dennis was extremely possessive of Lynn. They were drinking heavily at the wedding reception when they began to argue. Dennis confessed that he had her followed a few nights before in an attempt to catch her cheating. Lynn was livid. Screaming loudly for all the wedding guests to hear, she announced to Dennis that their relationship was over. And then Lynn stormed off. She headed straight to Babcock Grill, a bar her mother owned, and ducked inside. She thought Dennis wouldn't dare follow her there, but she was wrong. Dennis burst into the bar, yelling, and Lynn took off again. She headed to her house just a few doors down from the bar, and Dennis once again followed her. When he barged through Lynn's front door, Crystal had already brought her the phone to summon the police. Dennis knocked it from Lynn's grasp, but she still managed to call 911 and report an unwanted guest. Seething, Dennis finally left to avoid a confrontation with police, and Lynn hung up the phone. She reportedly told Crystal not to answer the door when the police arrived. She was worried she would get in trouble for leaving her children home alone, and then she grabbed her purse and walked out the door. She headed back to the Babcock Grill to keep drinking. It was around midnight. There, she met up with an ex-boyfriend, Michael Nichter. But just 20 minutes later, Dennis Donahue showed up. Seeing Lynn and her ex engrossed in conversation, Dennis charged at them in a jealous rage. He grabbed Lynn by the arm and tried to drag her out of the bar. Lynn managed to break free and Dennis stormed off. Lynn and Michael took this chance to dash out to Michael's car and flee. But just as Michael was about to shift the car into gear, Dennis reportedly appeared from the shadows. He reached through the open window, grabbed a fistful of Michael's hair, and slammed his head into the steering wheel. Michael struggled out of Dennis's grasp, then hit the gas, speeding out of the parking lot. But Dennis still wasn't ready to let Lynn leave him. He hopped in his own car and tailed after them. At an intersection, he pulled alongside Michael and Lynn, screaming at them. Trying to scare him off, Michael pulled out his gun. It seemed to work. Dennis turned down a side street, taking off in the opposite direction. Relieved, but full of adrenaline, Lynn and Michael decided to spend the rest of the early morning hours at a local nightclub. There, Lynn asked Michael if she could stay at his place that night. She was terrified Dennis would be waiting for her outside of her apartment. Instead, Dennis was waiting outside Michael's door. He immediately threw Michael against the wall and put a knife to his throat. Even with his entire weight pressing against Michael, a knife to his neck, Dennis was only focused on Lynn. He again accused her of cheating, But Lynn stayed steadfast, screaming at Dennis for what felt like the 100th time that night to go away and to leave her and her family alone. Then suddenly, Dennis put his knife away. Shocked, Lynn and Michael watched as he stormed back to his car and drove off. Lynn, though drunk, was wary. She didn't trust the way Dennis just walked away from the fight. Dennis never ended an argument by retreating. Then suddenly, she realized Dennis might show up at her house and try and hurt her kids. In a panic, she called a neighbor at 4:45 in the morning. She asked them to check on Crystal and Edward, and the neighbor agreed. The neighbor later assured her that they had checked on the kids and all was well. But Lynn, still worried, asked Michael to drive her back to the house so she could check on them herself. While Michael waited in the living room, Lynn poked her head into her kids' bedrooms around 5 a.m. Both were fast asleep. She put the phone and dog in Crystal's room, just in case Dennis showed up. Then Lynn and Michael left. Lynn told detectives that it was later that afternoon, when she returned from Michael's house, that she found Crystal dead. In a haze, she called her friend Keith Kramer before calling the police. When Keith arrived, he called 911. As Lynn wrapped up her account of the night of February 13th and the morning of the 14th, detectives Michael Lyons and Henry Smards were stunned. Lynn had claimed she was worried Dennis would hurt her children, yet she went back out again, leaving them alone and vulnerable. The logic just wasn't adding up. What kind of mother was she? Putting their initial judgments about Lynn aside for the moment, the detectives instead focused on Dennis Donahue. This man had stalked Lynn for hours and clearly had a violent streak. Lynn was convinced he was involved in Crystal's death. She swore she heard Dennis mumble something about her kids while he held a knife to Michael's throat. And when Detectives Lyons and Smards ran a background check on Dennis Donahue, it revealed he was a suspect in another open investigation, the 1975 murder of a middle-aged woman named Carol Reed. And the details seemed very familiar. Coming up, detectives find parallels between Crystal's murder and the unsolved homicide of Carol Reed.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Samsung, Expedia, and Sephora. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, back to the story. On Valentine's Day of 1993, 13-year-old Crystalyn Gerard was found murdered in her bedroom by her 29-year-old mother, Lynn Dejack. Lynn immediately suspected her boyfriend, Dennis Donahue, and investigators agreed with her, especially after finding out he was connected to a similar unsolved murder roughly 18 years before, the 1975 killing of Carol Reed. Carol Reed was a middle-aged woman living alone in Buffalo, New York. She was discovered dead in her apartment on September 9, 1975. Like Crystal, she was found naked on her back, strangled to death. Dennis Donahue, then 23, lived down the hall from Carol. His proximity made him a person of interest, and he was brought in for questioning during the investigation. But the murder quickly went cold, as there was no concrete evidence linking anyone to the crime. Now, 18 years later, another victim was found in similar circumstances, in close proximity to Dennis Donahue. As Detective Michael Lyons was working on background checks, he received a call from Lynn Dejack. After investigators left the crime scene, she found a rolling pin from the kitchen covered in blood, as well as a bloody towel. Officers returned to collect the evidence. The rolling pin, towel, and other swabs from the scene were put into evidence bags. Already in 1993, DNA was widely used in investigations, and these items could potentially hold incredibly important forensic information. But it was also a time of change in DNA technology. Tests were being developed that could analyze smaller amounts of genetic material, but not all labs were using cutting-edge methods, and this technology wasn't yet available to the Buffalo Police Department. While they continued collecting and cataloging evidence, they decided to question their top suspect, Dennis Donahue. Detective John Vickard from the Buffalo Police Department took Dennis into the station for questioning. Unexpectedly, he admitted to most of the things Lynn accused him of, animatedly describing how he stalked Lynn on the night of the murder, claiming he was angry at her for stepping out on him. He even confessed to pulling the knife on Lynn's ex-boyfriend, Michael Nichter. But when Detective Vickard asked about Crystal's murder, Dennis adamantly denied any involvement. Vickard, a trained interrogator, pushed back gently. He knew he had to play it right, or Dennis would just lawyer up. They would get nothing out of him after that. Instead, he simply asked Dennis where he went after he left Michael's house. Dennis, who had been so open about the events of the night, suddenly had very little to say. No matter how Vickard came at him, Dennis kept his alibi vague, refusing to commit to any details. At a loss, Vickard flat out accused Dennis of going back to the apartment to kill Lynn. When she wasn't there, he turned on Crystal instead. But Dennis wouldn't budge. He continued to deny that he had anything to do with Crystal's death. So Vickard shifted his strategy. He suggested Dennis take a lie detector test to prove he didn't kill Crystal. Eager to clear his name, Dennis agreed. Lie detectors, or polygraphs, record physiological changes during questioning, like heart rate, blood pressure, and respiratory rate. It's believed that if a person spikes in any of these areas, it's indicative of lying. In 1998, the Supreme Court ruled them inadmissible in federal trials, citing a lack of scientific consensus as to their reliability. But in 1993, these tests were still viewed as generally reliable. As the examiner set Dennis up for his polygraph session, he attached a blood pressure cuff to Dennis's arm. Then he wrapped two bands around Dennis's torso, one on his chest and the other across his abdomen. Finally, he put probes on Dennis's fingertips. All hooked up, Dennis was ready for the test. Dennis was initially prompted to answer control questions to check his baseline response to telling the truth. Once those responses were established, he was then interrogated about details related to Crystal's murder. He was asked if he was at the scene of the crime, if he knew who killed Crystal, and finally, if he had killed Crystal himself. With every question, Dennis, seemingly unaffected, answered no. Once the test ended, The polygraph examiner took Dennis's printout straight to the detectives to show them the results. Dennis passed with flying colors. While Dennis was at the station, seemingly clearing his name with the polygraph test, the Buffalo police searched his apartment. There, they recovered a blood-stained shirt and a blood-covered knife. But by the time the police returned to the station with the evidence, the detectives had shifted their focus off Dennis. He'd passed the polygraph. He wasn't their guy. In fact, Dennis volunteered to give a DNA sample to further clear his name. To detectives, this only confirmed his innocence. However, police never actually collected his sample, seeing it as unnecessary. Instead, detectives returned to Lynn Dejack. However, unlike Dennis, Lynn had an alibi, her ex-boyfriend, Michael Nichter. Lynn had spent the entire night that Crystal was killed with Michael, and Michael's statement backed her up entirely. He told detectives that he waited in the living room around 5 in the morning on February 14th while Lynn checked on Crystal. That's when he had overheard Lynn say something to Crystal and heard a mumbled reply from the teenager. He didn't know what was said, but he believed Crystal was alive at this point. But then he told police that he dropped Lynn off at her home before 1 p.m., and Lynn didn't call her friend Keith about finding Crystal dead until 2 p.m. Michael went on to say that about 30 to 45 minutes after he dropped her off, Lynn called him, but he let the call go to his answering machine. Lynn was crying and begging Michael to pick up the phone. Figuring she was calling about another fight with Dennis, he didn't pick up. He had gotten his fill of that drama the night before. This new timeline left a one-hour gap in Lynn's alibi, and an hour was plenty of time to commit a murder. They hoped the coroner's report of time of death would confirm their suspicions. But they had no such luck. The medical examiner determined that Crystal died between 11:25 p.m. on February 13th and 5:25 a.m. on the 14th. Crystal was definitely deceased before Lynn arrived home, whether it was at 1 p.m. or 2 p.m. But this raised a new, critical question. If Crystal had already been murdered by the time Lynn checked in on her at 5 a.m., how would Lynn not have noticed? In addition to this new wrinkle was the question of Crystal's official cause of death. The autopsy reportedly showed that Crystal had a small amount of cocaine in her system, but not enough to induce an overdose. In addition, Crystal's head wound wasn't severe enough to be her primary cause of death. Instead, the medical examiner believed she was strangled. He found what he believed to be a thumbprint on Crystal's neck. A new theory about the crime emerged. Investigators now believed Lynn must have strangled Crystal after Dennis left the apartment, just before midnight on the 13th. She then stripped Crystal, leaving her nude on her bed to stage a sexual assault. And in the process, she accidentally left Crystal's underwear on the floor. Lynn was eager to have Crystal's body found while she had a solid alibi, so she tried to get a neighbor to go check on Crystal. When the neighbor failed to notice Crystal was dead, Lynn had Michael take her to the apartment at 5 a.m. There, she staged a fake conversation with Crystal that Michael could overhear. That way, she would have a witness to back up her account that Crystal was still alive when Lynn saw her that morning. But this was all theory, and the detectives needed evidence. They decided to talk to Lynn's neighbors in case anyone overheard anything useful. Lynn's neighbors had an earful for police. They characterized Lynn as a neglectful mother, regularly leaving Crystal alone to care for her 8-year-old brother. Lynn, in their eyes, cared far more for men and alcohol than she did for her own children. Many neighbors also told detectives that Lynn and Crystal had a strained relationship. They often heard the two arguing loudly. Some believed that Crystal resented how much responsibility her mom put on her young shoulders. But as for the night of the murder, none of Lynn's neighbors heard anything after Dennis and Lynn's fight around 11:45 that night. There wasn't a single witness during the approximate time of Crystal's death. The detectives grew frustrated with the lack of evidence. They believed they knew the who, when, and how of Crystal's murder, but all they could actually prove was that Lynn wasn't in the running for Mother of the Year. But it wasn't as if investigators were working with no evidence. In fact, they had a fair amount of samples taken from the crime scene, Crystal's rape kit, and Dennis's bloody t-shirt and knife. But for reasons that remain unknown, none of this forensic evidence was ever tested further. With no critical leads, detectives were at a loss. The investigation was at a standstill, and each passing week threatened to push Crystal's murder onto the cold case shelf. But everything changed in October of 1993 when detectives finally got the big break they were looking for. A man named Wayne Hudson approached the Erie County District Attorney, offering to share information related to the Crystal Girard case. Wayne claimed he knew who had killed Crystal. Coming up, Wayne Hudson delivers a startling confession.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They used to say, go west. What they meant was go forward. Find your own way. Make something out of nothing. It can be tempting to take it easy, but discovery doesn't wait. So this summer, see what it means to make the most of dawn, dusk, and every minute in between. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
Now back to the story. After 7 months, investigators had hit a wall in the Crystal and Girard murder case. After their top suspect, 40-year-old Dennis Donahue, passed a polygraph test with flying colors, they shifted their focus to Crystal's mother, 30-year-old Lynn Dejack. Then, in October of 1993, a man named Wayne Hudson came forward, claiming to have information on the case. When Wayne Hudson was arrested in Buffalo, New York, for passing bad checks, he was scared. He had two prior felony convictions. A third conviction would have him labeled a persistent offender under New York law. He was looking at a sentence of 25 to life. Facing the possibility of spending the rest of his days in prison, Wayne approached the district attorney's office in the hopes of making a deal. He was a longtime friend of Lynn Dejack and claimed he had information about the murder of her 13-year-old daughter. Wayne said that he was out at the bars with Lynn about 2 or 3 months after Crystal's murder. They started drinking early in the day and into the evening. The more intoxicated Lynn became, the more visibly distressed she was. She alternated between crying and taking sips of her beer. But when Wayne asked her what was wrong, she would shake her head and change the subject. Eventually, she looked down at the floor and told Wayne that she couldn't take the pressure anymore. She had to confess. Through sobs, Lynn told Wayne about how she had been drinking and doing cocaine with Dennis on the night Crystal died. By the time she got home, she was really messed up. She called 911 to get Dennis to leave, which he did, but then things got fuzzy. Crystal said or did something that set Lynn off, and she flew into a rage. Lynn then held her two hands in front of herself, slightly clawed, as she told Wayne about how she launched herself at Crystal. She grabbed her by the throat and squeezed until Crystal stopped moving. Afterward, Lynn couldn't believe what she had done. When the police arrived at the apartment soon after, Lynn froze. She forgot she had even called them. She stayed absolutely silent until they left. Then she set about staging the scene by moving Crystal to her bed and removing her clothing. Afterward, she went back to the bar for a drink. Immediately upon hearing this, an investigator from the DA's office, Cliff Braxton, discounted Wayne's testimony. He thought the story was unconvincing, if not entirely false. For one, Wayne couldn't pinpoint when Lynn's supposed confession took place. But even more dubious was the fact that Wayne's account contradicted what witnesses had already told the police. Other bar patrons recalled seeing Lynn at the Babcock Grill at the same time the police were knocking on her door, responding to her 911 hang-up. She couldn't have been home. It was simply impossible for her to be in two places at once. Braxton also knew that Wayne had a very clear motivation to lie, facing a felony third strike. His testimony had to be taken with a grain of salt. However, Frank J. Clark III, Chief Assistant District Attorney of Erie County, ignored his investigator. To Clark, Wayne's account was exactly what they needed. The story he told was in line with the theory of the crime that the Buffalo detectives had already developed. They knew that the only window when Lynn could have killed Crystal was after Dennis left the apartment, but before she showed up at the bar. And that was exactly when Wayne said the crime occurred. Clark realized there were issues with Wayne's statement, but after 8 months with no leads, his testimony reignited the case. Clark was known for being a hard-hitting prosecutor, a mentality he likely formed as a combat platoon leader in the Vietnam War. When he decided someone was guilty, he did everything he could to put them behind bars. But Chief Assistant D.A. Clark knew he needed more than Wayne Hudson, a man with two felony convictions, to get the case off the ground again. So he called Dennis Donahue in to talk. Clark asked him to testify for the grand jury and possibly at a trial. He wanted Dennis to discuss Lynn's out-of-control drinking and anger issues. Surprisingly, Dennis hesitated. Clark assumed the jilted boyfriend and former prime suspect would be eager to work towards Lynn's conviction. But Dennis was wary that he was falling into a trap. He knew police were looking at Lynn as a suspect, but he wasn't sure they were completely off his back. He didn't want to inadvertently incriminate himself in some way. Seeing it would take some coaxing, Clark extended an unusual offer. If Dennis would testify for the state, Clark would grant him transactional immunity. Transactional immunity is more commonly called blanket or total immunity. It meant that no matter what happened, Dennis could never be prosecuted for any crimes related to Crystal's murder. Dennis readily agreed. In late 1993, a grand jury heard the state's argument in the Crystal Girard murder case. A grand jury isn't an actual trial as much as it's a test run for the state. As the jurors watch the prosecution present, they consider if they have enough evidence to charge a suspect. However, the attorneys of any defendants in the case are not present. This is by design. They don't know the hearing is taking place. Like in other states, the proceedings of a New York grand jury are secret. The only aspect of the grand jury that eventually becomes public are the names of any witnesses who are called to the official trial. Because of this, we know both Dennis and Wayne testified, and their testimonies must have been effective. After hearing the evidence, the grand jury ultimately determined there was enough evidence against 30-year-old Lynn Dejack to proceed to trial. But as the state formulated their plan of action to charge Lynn Dejack with her daughter's murder, Lynn had attempted a fresh start. In the time since Crystal's death, Lynn tried to make a new life for her and 9-year-old Edward. She even started a serious relationship with a new man, Chuck Peters. Though she knew she was a suspect in Crystal's case, she never thought she would be arrested. She trusted that with enough time, the investigation would exonerate her. So it was a shock to Lynn when she opened her front door on December 13, 1993, to find that the police had arrived with handcuffs. As she was led to the squad car, Lynn thought of Edward. Now with both of his parents in jail for hurting his sister, he would be taken out of his home and placed in foster care. But even worse, Lynn was 4 months pregnant with twins. If convicted, her babies would be taken away from her at birth. First, she lost her daughter. Now, she could lose her other children as well. As Lynn watched her home shrink through the squad car window, she realized that her impending trial was not just going to be a fight for her freedom, but a fight to reunite her family. Thanks for listening to Not Guilty. We'll be back Thursday with Lynn Dejack's trial and the aftermath that turned this case on its head. You can find more episodes of Not Guilty and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Not Guilty, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Not Guilty on Spotify, just open the app and type Not Guilty in the search bar. Several of you have asked how to help us, and if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. In the meantime, based on the evidence presented, decide for yourself. Did Lynn Dejack kill her 13-year-old daughter, Crystalyn Gerard? And will the jury agree with you? Find out next week. Not Guilty was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Not Guilty is written by Charlie Worrell. I'm Vanessa Richardson.